So the ambulance pulls up. They go, they're in there 10 minutes, whatever they're doing. I don't know. I'm up on a roof watching. All of a sudden, he comes out in a stretcher. He's turbanized, meaning his head is bandaged up, the jaw. They sit him up in the ambulance with the doors open. Moultrie walks by. He goes down the street like he, average Joe citizen, looks in the ambulance and keeps walking. So he sees the guys turbanized sitting up, and they're like working on him, playing the whole act. You know?
He wants to make sure that he got his money's worth, right?
Exactly. So he goes off. Now, the biggest problem we had of all this, we knew Moultrie was going to call around to hospitals and to find out where this guy went to verify it even further. So we had to get a hospital to admit this guy in a computer, meaning that when he called the hospital and put and said the name, that the attending person at the desk would, oh yeah, he's here. That's a big deal. Yes, you know, it's a false admission. We went to several hospitals and we were all turned down.
Did you deal with to do that? The head of security?
The head of security first, who put us out in touch with the administrator, whoever was responsible for something like
Usually
that.
You'd have to go through like risk management or something like that.
Yeah. Of course, this was only a phone call.
Yeah, so they would be afraid that they would be sued over this or something, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Which is, I guess, a genuine...
I know how hospitals think, you know?
Yes, I'm sure you do. So we end up getting, I believe, the NYU on 34th Street to play ball with us. Okay, so the whole thing's set up. We give them the guy, Sean Considine's name, you know, whatever. They put him in the system. Now we're up on Moultrie's phone. Well, right afterwards, he called Schachter and said, basically, it's done. Guy's on his way to the hospital. He's talking to him as he's hanging out in the street.
Right.
So we're up on that call. Two detectives are listening to that downtown. So they go to the hospital. They drive around the block or somewhere. I don't know where they go. But he starts calling hospitals now. He leaves. He goes home. Now he starts calling frantically to hospitals. Everybody's, nope, nobody by that name, nobody by that name. And then he started in that neighborhood. I think Metropolitan was the hospital on 96th Street there. Mm-hmm. He started with that hospital and then worked his way all around the city. He even called police looking to say, hey, my uncle, I don't know where he was taken away. The neighbors told me by ambulance. I don't know where he went. And everybody's basically slamming the door in his face saying, look, I don't know. You have to call the hospitals.
Right.
So after numerous calls by him to these, you know, police, fire, trying to get answers into hospitals, he hits on NYU. Yep, we have him here. Okay, thank you, blah, blah, blah. He calls back Schachter, says it's done. Guy's in the hospital. This is where he is. After this, I don't know the exact timeline, but we wind up arresting Norman Schachter. Okay, we wind up arresting him. We do a search warrant on his house. We come up really with nothing, although there was a couple of dogs. We had to bring ESU with us. His house was in I believe Connecticut. I forgot the name of the town, but it's a pretty affluent town. So we had to go to Connecticut, so I had to go to the local jurisdiction and get a warrant in addition to our warrant, like an amendment of something that they required. So the judge up there signed off on it. We had to get their ESU team because there were, you know, we surveilled the property. There were dogs on the property in like these big fenced in areas, and they were big dogs. It was probably the dogs that, two of them or one of them that probably attacked Considine in the park, because they didn't destroy the dogs.
Right.
So they were there. So we wind up getting Connecticut PD. All of us are up there, and we're going to do this warrant. We wind up doing the warrant, and we don't really come up with anything. We take his computer at the time, which really never... No, I'm sorry. That did come up with the child porn was on his computer.
So was he a pedophile?
He was not. No. These were just... They were amateur. Like, there weren't child porn doing sexual acts. They were naked children, pretty much.
Okay.
So it's not like they were hardcore adult child. They were just kids that were naked.
But that's also illegal just to upload.
Oh, sure. I mean, you're talking teenagers and 10-year-olds. There were some photos of young kids, you know, laying on their stomachs and standing there and, you know, just standing straight up. Yeah, it was pretty bad.
Right.
So, but no, he was not a child.
Well, I'm surprised at this point you didn't involve another unit in getting Manhattan Special Victims involved.
Right, right. Well, look, don't think we didn't think of that.
Yeah, let's bring another unit in. We already have 15 units. Let's get it.
Yeah, I mean, the computer, you know, went to, you know, the computer.
Computer crimes units.
Yeah, they dissected.
Bring another unit in.
Yeah, we brought another unit in. Somebody else is involved now.
Yes.
But they didn't come up with anything hardcore. Just the photos that were given. And we had to also, you know, narcotics. You know, we had the crack. We had like 10 vials of crack.
God.
So we wind up arresting him. Now, one of the funny things when we arrested him, there was a dick pic in one of the photos, right? And we're looking at this photo, the DA, and we're looking at him, we're like, you know whose dick that is. Come on. It's got to be Shaftis. Now, you know, he had red pubes, right? So now we're like, yeah, it's got to be. In other words, a big fuck you to Considine. Not only am I going to do this, but I'm going to stick a picture of my dick to get you, you know, to get you busted, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So we knew that. That was, you know, that was obvious. So I have to pull him out of the tombs, and they want to photograph him. They want to photograph his penis, right?
Yeah.
So now I bring him upstairs to the DA's office. We find a small room where the photographer is, this male photographer. I had to get a male.
Right.
And now, you know, and we have to get a warrant, I believe, to do this too. This involved more paperwork going through his attorney, you know, in front of a judge, why we want to humiliate this man and take a picture of his privates, you know. So this is all, you know, this is days. This isn't something that's happening quick.
No, of course not.
So sure, you know, we did. Now there was a mole on his genitalia, you know. So it was distinct. It was distinctive, you know. It was almost like, I don't know if you ever saw Porky's.
I thought you were going to tell me that you did a dick lineup or something, you know.
that would have been.
They picked him out, you know.
Yeah, well, if you ever saw the movie Porky's, do something like that. I know that mole anywhere. So we bring him into the office. Now it's myself, the photographer, and him. So now, you know, I'm like, look, take off your clothes. He knew why we were there. Right. And now we have him sitting on the floor. We have his legs up in the air, and she's snapping away. I mean, the humiliation on this guy.
Oh, my God.
You know, she's snapping away, and sure
You mean he is snapping away.
I mean, he's snapping away, right? So, sure enough, it's his. There's no question. You know, put them side by side.
Or comparison of the photos revealed that it was, in fact, his penis.
It was, in fact, his penis. So,
I don't know why I started looking like a lawyer, you know?
Yeah, I mean, the lawyer, of course, he didn't want to do it. They were bitching, you know, are you kidding me? Blah, blah, blah.
This is outrageous, Your Honor. This is outrageous behavior.
Yeah. That's how it was. Yeah. You know, you're right. It was exactly like that. So now, you know, we have that. Now we have to get Moultrie, right? So we make Schachter. Somehow we get Schachter to call Moultrie to tell him to bring down bail money because his wife was arrested for something. So Moultrie comes down to 100 Center Street thinking he's going to bail out Schachter's wife, and we wind up grabbing him in the lobby of 100 Center Street.
Just to be clear, Moultrie is the dog trainer.
He's the dog trainer that hired this guy Johnson, the parolee.
Yes.
To carry this.
This gets convoluted. We're, you know, we're detectives and sergeants. We're used to these stories, and we, you know, sometimes I'll even write the players down so I don't forget, you know.
Right, right.
The audience will keep reminding them who these players are, right?
Right, exactly. So we wind up getting him, of course, you know, he gives up Schachter and say, look, this guy approached me and he's paying me money. Now we have payments between those two also, these Western Union payments and phone calls. Why? Like, we have him dead to rights, all the plays. The only one who wasn't involved was Debbie Gamel. She really wasn't involved with any of this. She knew about it, but she wasn't, involved.
She didn't do anything that could implicate her into actually getting prosecuted for this.
Right. Okay. So she, you know, she didn't get arrested during this whole thing.
Because actually knowing about it is not a crime. You have to do some overt act.
Right. But if she would have paid for some of it or something, it all came from him.
Right.
You know? So all the players are arrested. Now, you know, we go to trial. They take it to trial. You know, they separated them at trial, of course. And Schachter winds up getting 10 years.
Wow.
10 years. And Moultrie, 7.
That's a
unbelievable.
That's a heavy-duty sentence for that, you know?
It was, but they charged him with a slew of crimes, from child porn to drug possession to burglary. You know, even though he didn't go in the apartment, but in essence, it's really a burglary. They went, he enabled them to go in and commit a crime, you know, the undercovers. And, so they charge him with burglary, drug possession, child pornography possession, assault, conspiracies, you know, things, you know, all now those this, kind of charges. So they hammered him.
This was 10 years that he was sentenced after trial.
After trial.
Yeah, so he didn't. Yeah. There was no plea. He took this to trial.
No.
And got 10 years.
Yeah.
And did he have any?
Again, he doing, well,
I was going to ask you, did he have any kind of criminal history before this?
No, he didn't.
Nothing.
He didn't. No, not that I remember. No, but I believe they made offers, and once again, he thought he was smarter than everyone else, I think.
And what did Schachter do for a living?
I think he was in, he did have a legit, oh, cleaning, dry cleaning, I think. I think he owned a couple of dry cleaning stores.
He owned the stores, okay.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He had some money. I forgot what neighborhood in Connecticut, but they had a nice house.
Uh-huh.
You know, they had a nice house. I'd love to see where they are today, if they're still together.
Well, if you get sentenced to 10 years.
But they were no big deal.
Right.
So, but they did time. You know, they did time, and he did a lot of time. And this is, you know, this is an old, fat, redheaded, balding guy who wanted to be the tough guy. And really, the reason why he did this was to be like, hey, I'll take care of this baby. You know, don't you worry about it. And right, it snowballed right. And a lot of work went into it. I mean, this was over a long amount of time with these wiretaps and all kinds of meets with the undercovers and, you know, and Moultrie. And, yeah, it was –
And it really blew up in his face. I mean,
it literally, yeah, you know? It blew up in his face. I don't think he thought it would have went this far, and it was as serious as a crime. You know, when he got locked up, he probably thought, oh, you know, they got me for this. But when he looked at all those charges, he forgot about the drugs. He forgot about the burglary.
Right.
He forgot about the child porn. That hey, I can be charged. I supply child porn. You know what I mean? Like, but he didn't think of any of this.
Didn't his attorney explain all of that to him before he thought he was going to, just beat the charges?
You would think so. You would think so. But he had a very arrogant personality. You could tell just by dealing with him. Like he was an arrogant guy.
Yeah.
You know, you could see it. But I listen. He's obviously he's out by now. I'm sure.
Let me ask something. When he was arrested, mm-hmm. Did he make a statement?
No. No, lawyered up immediately.
Oh, he lawyered right up.
He
knew the game. He was educated. He was smart.
Yeah, he was smart about
smart
that.
Smart enough
yeah.
to.
But he did agree to make that call to Moultrie to get him down, though, with his attorney present.
Okay.
He did agree to do that. So they must have, I don't remember why, you know, the DA must have made some kind of offer or something.
We'll get you pizza your first week in prison.
Yeah, I don't know. But at that time, I don't think any offers were on the table or it hadn't gone that far yet, you know?
Right.
This was just still the beginning of the case. So.
And the guy, the victim, mm-hmm. did you ever find out how he did in civil court as far as suing?
I didn't. I'm sure he's still sued, but, you know, who knows? Who knows? That's something, I'll look up.
You know, he had some money, the guy.
He did? Oh, yeah. He was an author. Nice apartment. Yeah, yeah. I mean, he wasn't swimming in it, but he, you know, and he was a typical Upper East Sider. He was snooty himself. You know, he was no bargain, but at least he played ball with us, you know. But, you know, it was getting, you know, revenge in a sense, you know.
To our audience, when Detective Hovigim says a typical Upper East Sider, I just give you a little example of that. Sometimes when the police go to these really ritzy buildings, the doorman will say, oh, would you mind using the service entrance?
Oh.
And most detectives will say, yes, I do mind. I'm coming through the front door, and I'm using the human elevator, not...
Right. I'm sure your partner on Off the Cuff, Mark, being the doorman...
That's right, that's right.
He would probably be the biggest ball breaker. He's like, no, you guys can't come through here.
That happened. I mean, that used to happen on the Upper West Side, too. They would say, would you mind taking the service entrance?
Sure. It's happened to me, and like you said, we said, no, get out of my way.
No, I'm not taking the service.
Of course we're not taking the service entrance, you know.
They must get in that in their doorman training, you know. If the police or the fire department or anyone who's a civil servant comes to the door, make them use the service entrance.
It's all about protecting the building.
Our tenants are flat. They're horrified by civil servants.
Yeah, yeah. It's all about protecting the building and the tenants from the, you know,
I remember there was this huge case, and I remember the guy who did like 5 murders, and he murdered the dry cleaning lady in the 19th precinct.
Sure. The only reason why we got him, that was what was his name? I worked on that case. We got a thumbprint on the outside of the window
of the dry cleaner.
Of the dry cleaner. So I was in the room when we got the statement. Detective Mike Charles did a great job. You know, because that thumbprint meant nothing. It was on the sidewalk side.
Well, my only point in bringing that up was that we were canvassing buildings on the Upper West Side. And when we tried to go up to the apartments, a few of the tenants called the doorman and said, do not let the police come up to my apartment. And the apartment overlooked the scene where he bashed a woman almost to death in Central Park. And we're like, oh, one of your neighbors almost was beaten to death.
Yeah,
you're unwilling or unable to allow the police to question to see if you saw anything.
Right.
Oh, how horrible. We're intruding upon your day, you know?
Well, Bill, how many times were we sent back in different homicides on the Upper East Side to canvass the building again and again and again? And we're knocking on these people. You're like, look, you've been here 3 times. I didn't see anything different than I told you the first time. And people would get pissed.
Oh, yeah.
High rises. I mean, they would get pissed. You know, the smartest man in the police department, go canvass it again. You know, Philip Pulaski with his checklist. You know, go canvass again. All right, we already did it. Go do it again.
Go do the no answer apartments. Like,
Go do the no answers. And then we're bothering the doorman again. And you know, and then we'd be stepping all over each other. Oh, I thought you did this building. No, I did this building. Blah, blah, blah. You know, like, it was just ridiculous.
The police department its own worst enemy sometimes, you know.
In that sense, they were. I would have been, if I was a tenant, look, you know, stop bothering me.
Yeah, leave me alone. I didn't see it.
Leave me alone. You're banging on my door. You know, and detectives, we don't have any sense of time. Oh, yeah, it's 10 o'clock at night. Let's go re-canvass. It's a Sunday night at 10 o'clock. You know, we don't care. We're working, you know, we're working till 1.
Well, it's the same thing in East Harlem, the 2-3. We get a shooting at 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning.
Right.
Knocking on people's doors at 3 in the morning. And it's like, or a murder right in the hallway or something. And, you know, we had to do it. We couldn't tell our bosses, oh, we didn't want to wake the people up. They'd be like, what? Right?
Right. They had no compassion for the working men and women that had to get up the next day. Right. You know, you're banging on their, you know, hey, did you see anything? Did you hear anything? You know, I mean, they're half asleep, first of all.
Right.
You know, but.
And usually, Tom, we tell our audience, most of the time, like 95% of the time, canvases are unfruitful.
Right? Yes, very true.
But it's an investigative checklist. That has to be done.
It does. It's definitely because you never know. You might get that diamond in the rough witness that says,
it happens. It's just like, you know what? It was also a procedural thing that I was like, I've never seen in my career this work. And then one shooting, it worked. And that was one homicide, actually. That was taking down all the license plate numbers of the cars surrounding the crime scene.
Yes.
And I was like, I've never seen that work. It's so time consuming. And then one murder we had, sure enough.
It worked.
It worked.
The plate,
it was from Delaware. They took it down. It was the shooter, you know.
And he was from it was a Delaware plate.
It was a Delaware plate, yeah.
Oh, wow. That's
right outside. It was the 125th and Amsterdam project there.
Oh, okay.
And it was parked outside there. And I was the only time in my police career I ever saw that procedural thing, checklist thing, worked and turned and bore fruit, and who the actual shooter was.
Wow, that's interesting. I never had a hit with something like that.
Yeah, isn't that unbelievable? But you know that you have to do it. right?
Sure. Yeah.
And as a boss, if that's not done when they read the complaint follow-ups, the DD5s, wait a minute. No one ever wrote down the, well, how come that wasn't? And you're like, oh my God. Yeah.